Congresswoman Elizabeth Esty, one of my favorite people in the House of Representatives, Democrat of Connecticut's 5th District, in office since 2013. Congresswoman, let me start by asking you about entrepreneurship and women.
Well, I'm really glad you brought that up. When I was home last week, I was at the fantastic celebration, really, of women in innovation in Connecticut. There were over 500 people, the vast majority of them women, recognizing leaders from all different sectors, professors and grad students, actually some high school students, engineers and medical researchers from all across the state of Connecticut who were doing cutting-edge work in the STEM fields. And I was particularly pleased when the award for an educator was given. It was a woman who's from one of the Bridgeport schools, and she has really specialized in designing curriculum to attract and be accessible and enticing to young women and to children of color. That's an issue, as I think you know, I'm really passionate about. I think there's an enormous opportunity and a need, frankly, for our country to make sure that all of our children have these skills, because there's so much innovation that comes when you've got this skill set, and we can't really have more than half the country not in a position to hold those high-skilled jobs and to make those discoveries. And she reported how she had received a National Science Foundation grant to develop a computer science curriculum, and that grant actually was a product of the bill that I got signed into law by the president last year. My STEM Education Act included that provision to give the National Science Foundation a push and encourage them and allow them to provide grants around computer science education. And she, not knowing that, she got up and as part of her remarks said, and I'm really so grateful the National Science Foundation has given me this grant to help develop better curriculum and more enticing curriculum on computer science. So that's how legislation is supposed to work. That's how it's supposed to work, make a real difference in people's lives.
So what is the prejudice against women? Why are they underpaid by a lot? As the president,
well, I think there are a lot of issues on this. We have different fields people are encouraged to go into. Some of it's subtle and some of it's blatant. And there's definitely been progress in my lifetime on, equal pay for equal work. But I'll just take, for example, entrepreneurship and look at some of those reports that came out of Silicon Valley in the last year of just gross underrepresentation of women in the high-tech industry. Well, there's been enormous growth there. If you don't have women coming in the door, and they tend to fall off the career track much faster. And I put together an advisory committee on this issue in my district, and a lot of the younger women will say it's been very hard. They don't have mentors. There's inflexibility about, adjusting their lab schedule, things like that just make a big difference if they're trying to juggle a career and families, and some relatively minor tweaks and adjustments could make it easier for them to do their work. But if the people in charge of the lab or the people in charge of making those decisions think there's only one way to do it and they should do it just the way they did, and you ought to be working 100 hours a week and no flexibility. If I call you at 2 a.m., you got to be here just the way I was treated and someone took care of things at home, then it's not going to change. So there are a lot of, some of it's culture change, some of it's actually legal change. There are places still where women are paid less for doing exactly the same work. And we need to continue to ensure that there's legal redress for that. But we also need to make sure that the skill sets and the opportunities are available to women. And that includes entrepreneurship. And that's my recent bill that passed a couple of weeks ago is on, encouraging in these fields where we're seeing so much potential growth, making it more possible for women to get support and in those fields.
So you mentioned that there were some tweaks that would help things along. Name some.
Well, some of these part of this is our collecting information about what are these barriers. Why is it that we don't have as many women applying for SBA loans? What's happening with that? What's happening with retention of women in the STEM fields? So that they get better mentoring. We get better data around investment. it's something that the state of Connecticut is actually doing some really important work. So I'm looking and building off of some of the work the state of Connecticut has done with Connecticut's Innovations, which is part of the state, our state efforts to do this, but trying to incorporate best practices that, for example, Connecticut has been using to be used on a more national scale. So that's part of what Congress's job is to do, is to take that laboratory of the states, good things that are going on in places, and saying, like, we want to make sure, you know, everybody's using best practices. And it's related to the kind of work a bunch of us have been doing on addressing the heroin epidemic. Again, it's a scourge. It's affecting our region horrendously. But there are programs that work better than others. There are communities that are developing effective policies, and we should be sharing those best practices. And that's one of the things I'm dedicated to, is to try to get that information and put it in the hands of, you know, my state and local counterparts to help save lives and do better.
It does appear that this heroin thing is not going away, and that it's just universal in this country. Do you know, I mean, you've been studying it, do you have any sense of what has caused this?
Well, I think there are a number of different pieces. And one of the things we've learned is, in fact, we've done a little better on clamping down on prescription drug abuse. So it's gotten harder to divert and misuse prescription drugs. Unfortunately, in the law of supply and demand, that's created a demand for narcotics that then is being met by the illegal drug trade. And we've also seen, you know, drug gangs moving into heroin, in part because it can be very cheaply manufactured. And the same thing is true with its close and more deadly cousin, fentanyl. And so a lot of the deaths actually are fentanyl or fentanyl heroin mixed. They're relatively cheap to produce, and we're seeing flows coming up actually from drug gangs in Central and South America. This has been actually a move from what have been other drugs. Right now, the drug of choice for the drug gangs and organized crime is heroin. And if you can buy a bag of heroin, a hit, as it were, for $1, $2, $3, or $5, compared with, say, $30 or $40 for a Percocet or some other prescription drug, you can bet that people are going to, you know, buy the $5 hit of heroin. And that's what we're seeing all over the country.
Is it your view that we can really do this thing and that we can really make a difference?
I know we can, and there are a number of different pieces. We clearly need to work on treatment and making sure beds are available and treatment programs that work well are available to people as soon as they're ready to accept treatment. I hear from families all the time, and we actually spend a fair amount of time trying to find beds for and treatment for and insurance coverage for people going through detox and then trying to stay clean. But I've also come to understand from my work with law enforcement and with families, with recovering addicts, with ER docs and medical professionals, that we need to do a much better job on prevention. So I introduced legislation a couple of weeks ago with two Republican colleagues, the Prevent Opioid Addiction Act, and the PREVENT Act, as we call it for short, is really focused on efforts we can do, and that includes public education campaign so that people are aware of the risks. You and I remember the smoking drug campaign, you know, the smoking campaigns. There have been drug ones as well, but the smoking campaigns were actually very, very effective. And so we are hoping to build on some of that to help people be aware of the risks here. That includes people who might use narcotics, but also family members. One of the other pieces, and that piece actually has largely been passed in the Senate. That was included in the Senate bill that passed last month. I have other pieces, though, too, and one of them is actually to provide better education and support for anybody in the medical profession who has a license to prescribe narcotics. This means dentists. This means, you know, this means trainers who are dealing with athletes. This means orthopedists. It means your general intern. It means ER docs. So that anyone who is prescribing narcotics needs to go through training before they get that license or before they get it renewed, 12 hours of training about the addictive products, properties of narcotics, to be aware of those risks better understanding of alternative management practices, and also how to wean people off, keeping shorter prescribing courses, wean them off of drugs, powerful narcotics faster. And in fact, the Centers for Disease Control just issued new guidelines a couple of weeks ago to call on physicians to prescribe shorter courses of narcotic treatment because of the risk. So I think there are a bunch of different factors, and you know, public education campaigns in languages and tailored to communities that are feeling the impact most strongly right now.
Well, Elizabeth Estey, we thank you. We know how busy you are. You've given us a tremendous amount to think about here. And, you know, it's always fun having you because you know more than I do, and that's great.
Oh, there's plenty of things you know more about than I do. You just pick the ones I happen to know about.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Alan. Always great to be with you.